Awesome. All right, so my name is Nathan Johnson, and I'll be talking to you about the multiplicative domain and quantum error correction. So really, the bulk of the talk is going to be on introductory stuff. We won't get to the new results until right at the end, and it'll be pretty brief. It'll be more of a primer for quantum error correction and how us mathies sort of approach it. So we'll be starting off with the finite dimensional Hilbert space script H, and as with Nishant's talk, we'll represent the space of operators on acting on H by L of H. If we have a map phi, it'll be said to be completely positive if whenever we tensor on another Hilbert space to it, it's still positive no matter how large that ancillary Hilbert space is. And thanks to Choi's theorem from the 70s, we know that phi is completely positive if and only if there exists this family of Krause operators, such that phi can be represented in this operator sum form here. I'll be using dagger for the operator adjoint, conjugate transpose, however you want to call it. And for brevity, sometimes I'll say that phi is just equal to that set of Krause operators. All right, so maybe as a service to physics people in the audience, in the Schrodinger picture of quantum dynamics, time evolution, we model by completely positive trace-preserving maps, which means the map E, if we expect it to have some sort of quantum meaning, is going to have a trace preservation quality to it, which just means that the trace of E of rho equals the trace of rho, and that's equivalent to that equation there. And whenever E has this property, we'll refer to it as the quantum channel. On the other hand, if we're thinking in the Heisenberg picture, then time evolution is described by the dual map, E dagger, where E dagger is defined via the Hilbert-Schmidt inner product like that. And nice computational thing is that E has Krause operators EI if and only if E dagger has Krause operators EI dagger. And E is trace preserving if and only if E dagger is unital. And all right, so with that in mind, we can define correctable subsystems. This is a bit more general than correctability in terms of Nishant's talk. Nishant just spoke of correctable subspaces. Throughout my talk, I'm going to be talking about correctable subsystems. So if we have a subspace C, we decompose it into a subsystem, into subsystems A tensor B, and we say that B is a correctable subsystem whenever there's a left inverse. The left inverse, it has to be a quantum operation, so it has to be completely positive and trace preserving, so we can actually have a hope of implementing it. But the important thing is that whatever you put in on the B subsystem, you get it back after you do the correction operation R. You don't care what happens to the A subsystem. So you recover exactly correctable subspaces when the dimension of the A subsystem is just equal to 1. Some other special cases, R is called the correction operation, but some other special cases that people might be a bit more familiar with is if R equals the identity is a valid correction operation, then B is just called the noiseless subsystem because there's no noise going on it. Also, if R equals the identity is a valid correction operation and the dimension of A equals 1, then it's called a decoherence-free subspace, if you know that term. And we'll sometimes refer, for convenience sake, these correctable subsystems and subspaces as codes. All right, so the image to have in your mind of a correctable subsystem is this, where this guy up here is... It's the operators acting on that subsystem. It's not really a block. That really, strictly speaking, this is the picture for correctable subspaces, but basically all of the results sort of hold the same, whichever setting you're thinking of these operators on. So correctable subsystem looks like that, and it's a bit obvious from the physical interpretation, but it's a bit non-trivial from the mathematical standpoint that whenever you have a correctable subsystem, E acting on those operators just sort of duplicates them down into orthogonal subspaces, or subsystems, sorry. And because E is trace preserving, these constants here, P1, P2, P3, have to add up to 1. But really it is like a correctable subsystem. Really all that's happening is E is just sort of smearing it down the diagonal. And then your correction operation is just to project onto these three sort of sub-blocks there and then apply unitaries to bring everything back together. All right, and sort of a special case that hasn't been studied too much are unitarily correctable codes. And these are the case whenever our correction operation R, whenever we can take it to be just a conjugation by unitary map. So it only has one cross operator, and that cross operator is a unitary. And sort of the way to think about these physically is in order to correct it, you don't have to use a projection. The intuition that you get from this picture is you have to do a projection and then a conjugation by unitary to get back your original state. But the conjugation or unitarily correctable codes, you don't have to do that projection first. You just do a conjugation by unitary and you're good to go. And of course, noiseless subsystems and decoherence-free subspaces are both special cases of unitarily correctable codes, just when the unitary is the identity. And yeah, in terms of the previous image I showed you, unitarily correctable codes are those for which there's just a single block on the right, so instead of three in the toy picture I drew up there. All right, now sort of shifting focus a little bit to something apparently on first glance completely unrelated. We'll now assume we have a completely positive map phi, may or may not be a quantum channel. We don't care about trace preservation just yet. We will say we'll define the multiplicative domain of phi, denoted MD phi, by this guy. So you have 5a times 5b equals phi ab, and 5b times 5a equals phi ba. And that has to hold for all operators b. So really, I'll get to my points before my ad-libbing. So MD phi, first of all, it's a star algebra. So whenever a is in there, a star is in there. Whenever a and c are in there, a times c is in there. And whenever a plus c is in there, whenever a and c are in there, a plus c is in there. So it's got really great mathematical structure. And probably the most important thing is that phi, when you restrict to this set, it looks like a star homomorphism, which is basically just what this is designing it to do, right? Like it's a multiplicative domain. That's why it's called the multiplicative domain. So that's the nice property. So the way to think of this is just we're restricting the multiplicative domain is just where phi looks particularly nice. And well, if you think about it, correctable codes are just where the channel looks particularly nice. So maybe there'll be some overlap. Hint, hint. So very brief primer on star algebras in finite dimensions, which is our setting. If we have a star algebra, horrible script A. Then it always has the form direct sum of these tensors here, where this guy just means we have the identity on the A subsystems, and we have a full matrix algebra on the B subsystem, and a zero on the orthogonal complement. And since, in particular, the multiplicative domain of phi is an algebra, it must have this form. So to make a bit more precise, what I said in the last slide, since the multiplicative domain is where the map phi is particularly nice, maybe we can say something about correctability of these B subsystems here. And yeah, well, can we? And okay, I'll hammer in the intuition for the connection a little bit more. So the image of the multiplicative domain to have in the back of your head is it's an algebra, so it looks something like a block, maybe with some tensor factors, but and pretend that's a phi. Under phi, it just gets mapped to copies of that, because from the theory of star homomorphisms on finite dimensions, well, things just play nice, and this is the picture we get. Okay, so now I'll tell you a little bit about how the world is nice when we're dealing with unital maps. First off, is a result of Choi that shows how the multiplicative domain simplifies when the map that we're dealing with is unital. In other words, phi of the identity just gives us the identity. So his theorem is that, so phi is completely positive and unital map, then the multiplicative domain just coincides with this set, where instead of having a B here, basically we replace in the definition of the multiplicative domain, everywhere we saw a B, now we just have an A dagger. All right, so instead of having that multiplicative property have to hold on the whole space, we only require multiplicativity with a dagger, and that's enough to guess the multiplicative domain. So hey, that's nice. It suggests that maybe with completely positive map, it doesn't matter. It pulls in and out of completely positive maps. You can see that from the Choi-Kroos representation, right? Yeah. So yeah, if it makes you more comfortable, throw that on the inside there. In particular, this theorem, if E is a quantum channel, then this theorem applies to E dagger. Hey, hey. And a theorem of Cribbs and Speckens, much more recently than the last result I showed you, shows that we can unambiguously define the, imagine italics on V there, define the unitarily correctable code algebra for a unital channel. And we'll denote that algebra by UCC of E. And really what this is actually saying is whenever we have a unital channel, the unitarily correctable codes can be decomposed in this way, which looks very familiar. We can basically, what it's saying is that all of the unitarily correctable codes, while they're orthogonal, they're not interfering with each other in any way. So we can construct an algebra consisting exactly of those unitarily correctable codes. And it's not hard to construct examples, and we'll see one a bit later, that shows that there's no way to do this for general non-unital channels. You get weird overlaps, and if you try to construct the smallest algebra containing all of the unitarily correctable codes, things blow up and you get something that's pretty much useless. Now that we've built everything up, it's time for sort of the first theorem, and that is that the multiplicative domain coincides with a set of unitarily correctable codes, which you might have guessed by this point, in the case where E is a unital quantum channel. And, well, these guys are kind of nice, but from a physical standpoint, I imagine that they're not overly interesting. This is nice because we want to know unitarily correctable codes, and we know lots about multiplicative domains. In particular, they're easy to calculate, so now unitarily correctable codes are easy to calculate. So what the heck, let's consider an example. So I is the identity, and we don't need a Q anymore. I changed this example, so forget about that. But we have a channel acting on the 2x2 matrices over the operators on H, and it's given by these two Kroos operators. And so, if you want to do some quick mental math, yes, it's a channel, and hey, it is unital. So, our theorem from the previous slide applies to it, and what do we get? The multiplicative domain is that guy right there. So, that means this is exactly the algebra of unitarily correctable codes, and what that means is just imagine that you don't have B's there for a second, then that tells you that A's there. You're getting the 2x2 identity matrix tensored with the full matrix algebra. That guy is a unitarily correctable code, and in fact, it's not hard to check that it's actually a noiseless subsystem in this case. And same for the B's here are also giving you another unitarily correctable code, and they also happen to define another noiseless subsystem. If you want to get slightly less trivial unitarily correctable codes, then just throw some unitaries in these blocks instead of identity, and then you'll get some unitarily correctable codes that aren't noiseless. But the multiplicative domain is still the same, so you still capture them. All right, so the multiplicative domain unitarily correctable code theorem, it only applied for unital channels. So what the heck happens in the non-unital case? And unfortunately, if we're just looking at regular old-fashioned multiplicative domains, we can't say a whole lot because we can construct counterexamples to almost everything that we've said so far. But there is one inclusion that still holds in the general setting for non-unital channels, and that is if we just have any old quantum channel, then the quantum codes encoded in the multiplicative domain are unitarily correctable. It doesn't go the other way, though. We don't get all of the unitarily correctable codes. But when we compute the algebra multiplicative domain of E and decompose it in that funky direct sum tensor form that we had a couple slides ago, all of the BK algebras are unitarily correctable. So non-unital example time, and it's going to look very similar. And multiplicative domain now is just the zero matrix. And so, well, it doesn't tell us a whole lot. It doesn't tell us that there are no unitarily correctable codes, because the theorem doesn't go that way. It only goes the other way. And indeed, we see that there actually is a strict gap. We see that they are not equal in general, because, well, basically, we have one unitarily correctable code that looks like this. We have another unitarily correctable code that looks like this. So multiplicative domain tells us, for general channels, not a whole lot, which is maybe a bit unfortunate, but we'll see a way to rectify that as well. And also, to connect to something I said a bit ago, notice that the smallest algebra containing both of these algebras is this guy. Well, when you apply E to that algebra, so E of anything of that form gives you something of this form. So we see that this algebra, in particular, cannot be correctable, because there's no way to get back the stuff that's in the B block. In other words, basically what this shows is there's no way to define the UCC algebra for general non-unital channels, because stuff combines in ways, and basically the codes aren't always going to be orthogonal to each other. What it's saying is these codes aren't orthogonal, so if we try to describe the UCC algebra, things blow up. All right. So in order to generalize the UCC theorem to non-unital channels, we've got to define something a bit more general than just the old-fashioned multiplicative domain, which we call generalized multiplicative domains. So we have a completely positive map phi, star algebra with that horrible script A again, and a star homomorphism now going from that horrible script A algebra to L of H. Then we define the multiplicative domain of phi with respect to pi of phi. Forget about one of those of phis. Denoted MD sub pi of phi to be this guy, where now phi isn't being multiplicative with itself, but with another star homomorphism, or another map that's already multiplicative with itself. So things are a bit easier here. Well, one thing in particular is, whereas for every map phi, you only have one multiplicative domain, you have a whole bunch of these generalized multiplicative domains, depending on what pi you choose. And the thing about these is that there's no way that we know of beforehand to know how to get a good pi. Like, what we'll see is we will want these generalized multiplicative domains to be large, but in order to get them large, you're going to have to pick pi right, and doing that is basically equivalent to doing quantum error correction, which is, it's not going to be easy. So, anyway, as with the standard multiplicative domain, these generalized multiplicative domains, they're star algebras. So they have nice mathematical structure, at least. And in the case of unital quantum channels, we have some characterizations of the of these generalized multiplicative domains that are analogous to that theorem of Choi that we saw a bit ago. And there are also some connections with bind module maps and a few other sort of old school math things from the 70s, but yeah. So our motivation for defining these generalized multiplicative domains is, of course, quantum error correction, and in particular, this theorem. So if you use a quantum channel, unital, non-unital, whatever, and then we have a subsystem B, then the following are equivalent. B is a correctable subsystem for E, or two, there's the star homomorphism. We don't know how to get it, but we know it exists, such that the generalized multiplicative domain of E with respect to pi is exactly that correctable subsystem. So, yeah, so this is sort of in the same flavor as the original MD-UCC theorem that I described, and I don't know, depending on your background, it may or may not be trivial to see that a special case of these generalized multiplicative domains actually is the original multiplicative domain, so this theorem really is a generalization. But you can just take my word for it otherwise. So I guess some closing remarks. Since multiplicative domain is easy to compute, we have a simple way of computing unitarily correctable codes. for unital channels. And we saw that we can compute some unitarily correctable codes for non-unital channels, but we don't always get them all. And we saw these funky little generalized multiplicative domains that capture all codes for arbitrary channels, but we can't really compute them in a sort of generality. Like, we can pick some particular pi if we want to, but we're not likely to capture anything that's physically meaningful any large amount of the time anyway. Future steps from here. Can we compute generalized multiplicative domains in any sort of non-trivial generality? I don't think so. Sigh. We have some nice mathematical theory about these generalized multiplicative domains, though. Maybe just from a strictly mathematical point of view, what else can we say? Will we eventually stumble on some nice theory that can be applied to quantum error correction then if we do study them a bit more? Well, hopefully. And some references if you're so inclined.